was Nobu who'd brought in a group of investors and saved the company from ruin in the early 1920s. "I owe Nobu a debt I can never repay," the chairman was quoted more than once as saying. Several weeks passed, and then one day I received a note to come to Mameha's apartment the following afternoon. By this time, I'd grown accustomed to the priceless kimono ensembles that Mameha's maid usually laid out for me, but when I arrived and began changing into an autumn-weight silk of scarlet and yellow, which showed leaves scattered in a field of golden grasses, I was taken aback to find a tear in the back of the gown large enough to put two fingers through. Mameha hadn't yet returned, but I took the robe in my arms and went to speak with her maid. "Tatsumi-san," I said, "the most upsetting thing, this kimono is ruined."
"It isn't ruined, miss. It needs to be repaired, is all. Mistress borrowed it this morning from an okia down the street."
"She must not have known," I said, "and with my reputation for ruining kimono, she'll probably think—"
"Oh, she knows it's torn," Tatsumi interrupted. "In fact, the underrobe is torn as well, in just the same place."
I'd already put on the cream-colored underrobe, and when I reached back and felt in the area of my thigh, I saw that Tatsumi was right.
"Last year, an apprentice geisha caught it by accident on a nail," Tatsumi told me, "but Mistress was very clear that she wanted you to put it on."
This made very little sense to me, but I did as Tatsumi said. When at last Mameha rushed in, I went to ask her about it while she touched up her makeup. "I told you that, according to my plan," she said, "two men will be important to your future. You met Nobu a few weeks ago. The other man has been out of town until now, but with the help of this torn kimono, you're about to meet him. That sumo wrestler gave me such a wonderful idea. I can hardly wait to see how Hatsumomo reacts when you come back from the dead. Do you know what she said to me the other day? She couldn't thank me enough for taking you to the exhibition. It was worth all her trouble getting there, she said, just to see you making big eyes at Mr. Lizard. I'm sure she'll leave you alone when you entertain him, unless it's to drop by and have a look for herself. In fact, the more you talk about Nobu around her, the better, though you're not to mention a word about the man you'll meet this afternoon." I began to feel sick inside when I heard this, even as I tried to seem pleased at what she'd said, because, you see, a man will never have an intimate relationship with a geisha who has been the mistress of a close associate. One afternoon, in a bathhouse not many months earlier, I'd listened as a young woman tried to console another geisha who just learned that her new donna would be the business partner of the man she'd dreamed about. It had never occurred to me as I watched her that I might one day be in the same position myself.
"Ma'am," I said, "may I ask, is it part of your plan that Nobu-san will one day become my donna?"
Mameha answered me by lowering her makeup brush and staring at me in the mirror with a look that I honestly think would have stopped a train. "Nobu-san is a fine man. Are you suggesting you'd be ashamed to have him for a donna?" she asked.
"No, ma'am, I didn't mean it that way. I'm just wondering."
"Very well. Then I have only two things to say to you. First, you're a 14-year-old girl with no reputation whatever. You'll be very fortunate ever to become a geisha with sufficient status for a man like Nobu to consider proposing himself as your donna. Secondly, Nobu-san has never found a geisha he likes well enough to take as a mistress. If you're the first, I expect you to feel very flattered." I blushed with so much heat in my face I might almost have caught fire. Mameha was quite right. Whatever became of me in the years ahead, I would be fortunate even to attract the notice of a man like Nobu. If Nobu was beyond my reach, how much more unreachable the chairman must be. Since finding him again at the sumo exhibition, I'd begun to think of all the possibilities life presented to me. But now, after Mameha's words, I felt myself wading through an ocean of sorrow. I dressed in a hurry, and Mameha led me up the street to the okia where she'd lived until 6 years earlier, when she'd gained her independence. At the door, we were greeted by an elderly maid who smacked her lips and gave her head a shake.
"We called the hospital earlier," the maid said. "The doctor goes home at 4 o'clock today. It's nearly 3:30 already, you know."
"We'll phone him before we go, Kazuku-san," Mameha replied. "I'm sure he'll wait for me."
I hope so. It would be terrible to leave the poor girl bleeding.
Who's bleeding? I asked in alarm. But the maid only looked at me with a sigh and led us up the stairs to a crowded little hallway on the second floor. In a space about the size of 2 tatami mats were gathered not only Mameha and me, as well as the maid who'd shown us up, but also 3 other young women and a tall, thin cook in a crisp apron. They all looked at me warily except for the cook, who draped a towel over her shoulder and began to whet a knife of the sort used to chop the heads off fish. I felt like a slab of tuna the grocer had just delivered, because I could see now that I was the one who was going to do the bleeding.
"Mameha-san," I said.
"Now, Sayuri, I know what you're going to say," she told me, which was interesting, because I had no idea myself what I was going to say. "Before I became your older sister, didn't you promise to do exactly as I told you?"
"If I'd known it would include having my liver cut out—"
"No one's going to cut out your liver," said the cook, in a tone that was supposed to make me feel much better, but didn't. "Sayuri, we're going to put a little cut in your skin," Mameha said. "Just a little one, so you can go to the hospital and meet a certain doctor. You know the man I mentioned to you? He's a doctor."
"Can't I just pretend to have a stomach ache?"
I was perfectly serious when I said this, but everyone seemed to think I'd made a clever joke, and they all laughed, even Mameha. "Sayuri, we all have your best interests at heart," Mameha said. "We only need to make you bleed a little, just enough so the doctor will be willing to look at you." In a moment, the cook finished sharpening the knife and came to stand before me as calmly as if she were going to help me with my makeup, except that she was holding a knife, for heaven's sake. Kazuko, the elderly maid who had shown us in, pulled my collar aside with both hands. I felt myself beginning to panic, but fortunately, Mameha spoke up. "We're going to put the cut on her leg," she said. "Not the leg," said Kazuko. "The neck is so much more erotic." "Sayuri, please turn around and show Kazuko the hole in the back of your kimono," Mameha said to me. When I'd done as she asked, she went on, "Now, Kazuko-san, how will we explain this tear in the back of her kimono if the cut is on her neck and not her leg?"
"How are the two things related?" Kazuko said. "She's wearing a torn kimono, and she has a cut on her neck."
"I don't know what Kazuko keeps going on about," the cook said. "Just tell me where you want to cut her, Mameha-san, and I'll cut her." I'm sure I should have been pleased to hear this, but somehow I wasn't. Mameha sent one of the young maids to fetch a red pigment stick of the sort used for shading the lips, and then put it through the hole of my kimono and swiftly rubbed a mark high up on the back of my thigh. "You must place the cut exactly there," Mameha said to the cook. I opened my mouth, but before I could even speak, Mameha told me, "Just lie down and be quiet, Sayuri. If you slow us down any further, I'm going to be very angry." I'd be lying if I said I wanted to obey her, but of course I had no choice. So I lay down on a sheet spread out on the wooden floor and closed my eyes while Mameha pulled my robe up until I was exposed almost to the hip. "Remember that if the cut needs to be deeper, you can always do it again," Mameha said. "Start with the shallowest cut you can make." I bit my lip the moment I felt the tip of the knife. I'm afraid I may have let out a little squeal as well, though I can't be sure. In any case, I felt some pressure, and then Mameha said, "Not that shallow. You've scarcely cut through the first layer of skin."
"It looks like lips," Kazuko said to the cook. "You've put a line right in the middle of a red smudge, and it looks like a pair of lips. The doctor's going to laugh."
Mameha agreed and wiped off the makeup after the cook assured her she could find the spot. In a moment, I felt the pressure of the knife again. I've never been good at the sight of blood. You may recall how I fainted after cutting my lip the day I met Mr. Tanaka, so you can probably imagine how I felt when I twisted around and saw a rivulet of blood snaking down my leg onto a towel Mameha held against the inside of my thigh. I lapsed into such a state when I saw it that I have no memory at all of what happened next, of being helped into the rickshaw, or of anything at all about the ride, until we neared the hospital and Mameha rocked my head from side to side to get my attention. "Now listen to me.
I'm sure you've heard over and over that your job as an apprentice is to impress other geisha, since they're the ones who will help you in your career, and not to worry about what the men think. Well, forget about all that. It isn't going to work that way in your case. Your future depends on two men, as I've told you, and you're about to meet one of them. You must make the right impression. Are you listening to me?
Yes, ma'am. Every word, I muttered.
When you're asked how you cut your leg, the answer is you were trying to go to the bathroom in kimono and you fell into something sharp. You don't even know what it was because you fainted. Make up all the details you want. Just be sure to sound very childish and act helpless when we go inside. Let me see you do it. Well, I laid my head back and let my eyes roll up into my head. I suppose that's how I was really feeling, but Mameha wasn't at all pleased.
I didn't say act dead, I said act helpless. Like this.
Mameha put on a dazed look as if she couldn't make up her mind even where she should point her eyes, and kept her hand to her cheek as though she were feeling faint. She made me imitate that look until she was satisfied. I began my performance as the driver helped me to the entrance of the hospital. Mameha walked beside me, tugging my robe this way and that to be sure I still looked attractive. We entered through the swinging wooden doors and asked for the hospital director. Mameha said he was expecting us. Finally, a nurse showed us down a long hallway to a dusty room with a wooden table and a plain folding screen blocking the windows. While we waited, Mameha took off the towel she'd wrapped around my leg and threw it into a wastebasket.
"Remember, Sayori," she nearly hissed. "We want the doctor to see you looking as innocent and as helpless as possible. Lie back and try to look weak."
I had no difficulty at all with this. A moment later, the door opened and in came Dr. Crabb. Of course, his name wasn't really Dr. Crabb, but if you'd seen him, I'm sure the name would have occurred to you, because he had his shoulders hunched up and his elbows sticking out so much he couldn't have done a better imitation of a crab if he'd made a study of it. He even led with one shoulder when he walked, just like a crab moving along sideways. He had a mustache on his face and was very pleased to see Mameha, though more with an expression of surprise in his eyes than with a smile. Dr. Crabb was a methodical and orderly man. When he closed the door, he turned the handle first so the latch wouldn't make noise, and then gave an extra press on the door to be sure it was shut. After this, he took a case from his coat pocket and opened it very cautiously, as though he might spill something if he wasn't careful, but all it contained was another pair of glasses. When he'd exchanged the glasses he wore, he replaced the case in his pocket and then smoothed his coat with his hands. Finally, he peered at me and gave a brisk little nod, whereupon Mameha said,
"I'm so sorry to trouble you, Doctor, but Sayori has such a bright future before her, and now she's had the misfortune of cutting her leg. What with the possibility of scars and infections and the like, well, I thought you were the only person to treat her."
"Just so," said Dr. Crabb. "Now perhaps I might have a look at the injury."
"I'm afraid Sayori gets weak at the sight of blood, Doctor," Mameha said. "It might be best if she simply turned away and let you examine the wound for yourself. It's on the back of her thigh."
"I understand perfectly. Perhaps you'd be kind enough to ask that she lie on her stomach on the examination table?"
I couldn't understand why Dr. Crabb didn't ask me himself, but to seem obedient, I waited until I'd heard the words from Mameha. Then the doctor raised my robe almost to my hips and brought over a cloth and some sort of smelly liquid which he rubbed on my thigh before saying,
"Sayori-san, please be kind enough to tell me how the wound was inflicted."
I took a deep, exaggerated breath, still doing my best to seem as weak as possible.
"Well, I'm rather embarrassed," I began, "but the truth is that I was drinking a good deal of tea this afternoon."
"Sayori has begun her apprenticeship," Mameha said. "I was introducing her around Gion. Naturally, everyone wanted to invite her in for tea."
"Yes, I can imagine," the doctor said.
"In any case," I went on, "I suddenly felt that I had to, well, you know."
"Drinking excessive amounts of tea can lead to a strong urge to relieve the bladder," the doctor said.
"Oh, thank you. And in fact, well, strong urge is an understatement, because I was afraid that in another moment
everything would begin to look yellow to me, if you know what I mean.
Just tell the doctor what happened, Sayori, said Mameha.
I'm sorry, I said. I just mean to say that I had to use the toilet very bad, so bad that when I finally reached it, well, I was struggling with my kimono, and I must have lost my balance. When I fell, my leg came against something sharp. I don't even know what it was. I think I must have fainted.
It's a wonder you didn't void your bladder when you lost consciousness, said the doctor. All this time, I'd been lying on my stomach, holding my face up off the examination table for fear of smudging my makeup, and talking while the doctor looked at the back of my head. But when Dr. Crabb made this last comment, I looked over my shoulder at Mameha as best I could. Happily, she was thinking faster than I was because she said, What Sayori means is that she lost her balance when she tried to stand once again from a squatting position. I see, the doctor said. The cut was made by a very sharp object. Perhaps you fell on broken glass or a strip of metal.
Yes, it certainly felt very sharp, I said. As sharp as a knife.
Dr. Crabb said nothing more, but washed the cut as though he wanted to see how much he could make it hurt, and then, afterward, used more of the smelly liquid to remove the blood that had dried all down my leg. Finally, he told me the cut would need nothing more than cream and a bandage, and gave me instructions on caring for it over the next few days. With this, he rolled my robe down and put away his glasses as though he might break them if he handled them too roughly. I'm sorry you've ruined such a fine kimono, he said, but I'm certainly happy at the chance to have met you. Mameha-san knows I'm always interested in new faces.
Oh, no, the pleasure is all mine, doctor, I said.
Perhaps I'll see you one evening quite soon at the Ichiriki Tea House.
To tell the truth, doctor, Mameha said, Sayori is a bit of a special property, as I'm sure you can imagine. She already has more admirers than she can handle, so I've been keeping her away from the Ichiriki as much as I can. Perhaps we might visit you at the Shirei Tea House instead?
Yes, I would prefer that myself, Dr. Crabb said, and then he went through the whole ritual of changing his glasses again so that he could look through a little book he took from his pocket. I'll be there, let me see, 2 evenings from now. I do hope to see you.
Mameha assured him we would stop by, and then we left. In the rickshaw, on the way back to Gion, Mameha told me I'd done very well. But Mameha-san, I didn't do anything. Oh, then how do you account for what we saw on the doctor's forehead? I didn't see anything but the wooden table right in front of my face.
Let's just say that while the doctor was cleaning the blood from your leg, his forehead was beaded with sweat as if we'd been in the heat of summer. But it wasn't even warm in the room, was it?
I don't think so.
Well then, Mameha said. I really wasn't sure what she was talking about, or exactly what her purpose had been in taking me to meet the doctor, for that matter, but I couldn't very well ask because she'd already made it clear she wouldn't tell me her plan. Then, just as the rickshaw driver was pulling up across the Shizhou Avenue Bridge into Gion once again, Mameha interrupted herself in the middle of a story.
You know, your eyes really are extraordinarily lovely in that kimono, Sayori. The scarlets and yellows, they make your eyes shine almost silver. Oh, heavens, I can't believe I haven't thought of this idea sooner. Driver, she called out, we've gone too far. Stop here, please.
You told me Gion, Tominagicho, ma'am. I can't drop the poles in the middle of a bridge.
You may either let us out here or finish crossing the bridge and then take us back over it again. Frankly, I don't see much point in that.
The driver set down his poles where we were, and Mameha and I stepped out. A number of bicyclists rang their bell in anger as they passed, but Mameha didn't seem in the least concerned. I suppose she was so certain of her place in the world, she couldn't imagine anyone being troubled by a little matter like her blocking traffic. She took her time, holding up one coin after another from her silk change purse, until she'd paid the exact fare, and then led me back across the bridge in the direction we'd come.
We're going to Uchida Kasuburo's studio, she announced. He's a marvelous artist, and he's going to take a liking to your eyes, I'm sure of it. Sometimes he gets a little distracted, you might say, and his studio is a mess. It may take him a while to notice your eyes, but just keep them pointed where he can see them. I followed Mameha through side streets until we came to a little alley. At the end stood a bright red Shinto gate, miniature in size, pressed tightly between two houses. Beyond the gate, we passed between several small pavilions to a flight of stone steps leading up through trees in their brilliant fall coloring. The air wafting from the dank little tunnel of the steps felt as cool as water, so that it seemed to me I was entering a different world altogether. I heard a swishing sound that reminded me of the tide washing the beach, but it turned out to be a man with his back to us, sweeping water from the top step with a broom whose bristles were the color of chocolate. "Why, Uchida-san," Mameha said, "don't you have a maid to tidy up for you?" The man at the top stood in full sunlight, so that when he turned to peer down at us, I doubt he saw anything more than a few shapes under the trees. I could see him well, however, and he was quite a peculiar-looking man. In one corner of his mouth was a giant mole like a piece of food, and his eyebrows were so bushy they looked like caterpillars that had crawled down out of his hair and gone to sleep there. Everything about him was in disarray, not only his gray hair, but his kimono, which looked as if he'd slept in it the night before.
"Who is that?" he said.
"Uchida-san, after all these years you still don't recognize my voice."
"If you're trying to make me angry, whoever you are, you're off to a good start. I'm in no mood for interruptions. I'll throw this broom at you if you don't tell me who you are."
Uchida-san looked so angry I wouldn't have been surprised if he bit off the mole from the corner of his mouth and spat it at us. But Mameha just continued right up the stairs, and I followed her, though I was careful to stay behind, so she would be the one struck by the broom.
"Is this how you greet visitors, Uchida-san?" Mameha said as she stepped up into the light.
Uchida squinted at her.
"So it's you. Why can't you just say who you are like everyone else? Here, take this broom and sweep the steps. No one's coming into my house until I've lit incense. Another of my mice has died, and the place smells like a coffin."
Mameha seemed amused at this and waited until Uchida had left before leaning the broom against a tree. "Have you ever had a boil?" she whispered to me. "When Uchida's work goes badly, he gets into this terrible mood. You have to make him blow up, just like lancing a boil, so that he'll settle down again. If you don't give him something to get angry about, he'll start drinking and only get worse."
"Does he keep pet mice?" I whispered. "He said another of his mice had died."
"Heavens, no. He leaves his ink sticks out, and the mice come to eat them and then die from poisoning. I gave him a box to put his inks in, but he won't use it."
Just then, Uchida's door rolled partway open, for he'd given it a shove and gone right back inside. Mameha and I slipped out of our shoes. The interior was a single large room in the style of a farmhouse. I could see incense burning in a far corner, but it hadn't done any good yet, because the smell of dead mouse struck me with as much force as if someone had stuck clay up my nose. The room was even messier than Hatsumomo's at its worst. Everywhere were long brushes, some broken or gnawed, and big wooden boards with half-finished drawings in black and white. In the midst of it all was an unmade futon with ink stains on the sheets. I imagined that Uchida would have ink stains all over himself as well, and when I turned to find out, he said to me,
"What are you looking at?"
"Uchida-san, may I present my younger sister, Sayuri," Mameha said. "She's come with me all the way from Gion for the honor of meeting you." All the way from Gion wasn't really very far, but in any case, I knelt on the mats and went through the ritual of bowing and begging Uchida's favor, although I wasn't convinced he'd heard a word of what Mameha had told him.
"I was having a fine day until lunchtime," he said, "and then look what happened."
Uchida crossed the room and held up a board. Fastened onto it with pins was a sketch of a woman from the back, looking to one side and holding an umbrella, except that a cat had evidently stepped in ink and walked across it, leaving perfectly formed paw prints. The cat himself was curled up asleep at the moment in a pile of dirty clothes.
"I brought him in here for the mice, and look," he went on, "I've a mind to throw him out."
"Oh, but the paw prints are lovely," said Mameha. "I think they improve the picture. What do you think, Sayuri?"
I wasn't inclined to say anything, because Uchida was looking very upset at Mameha's comment, but in a moment I understood that she was trying to lance the boil, as she'd put it, So I put on my most enthusiastic voice and said, "I'm surprised at how attractive the paw prints are. I think the cat may be something of an artist."
"I know why you don't like them," said Mameha. "You are jealous of his talent."
"Jealous, am I?" Uchida said. "That cat's no artist. He's a demon if he's anything."
"Forgive me, Uchida-san," Mameha replied. "It's just as you say. But tell me, are you planning to throw the picture away? Because if so, I'd be pleased to have it. Wouldn't it look charming in my apartment, Sayuri?"
When Uchida heard this, he tore the picture from the board and said,
"You like it, do you? All right, I'll make you 2 presents of it."
And then he tore it in 2 pieces and gave them to her, saying, "Here's one, and here's the other. Now get out."
"I so wish you hadn't done that," Mameha said. "I think it was the most beautiful thing you've ever produced."
"Get out."
"Oh, Uchida-san, I can't possibly. I wouldn't be a friend if I didn't straighten your place a bit before leaving."
At this, Uchida himself stormed out of the house, leaving the door wide open behind him. We watched him kick the broom Mameha had left leaning against the tree, and then nearly slip and fall as he started down the wet steps. We spent the next half hour straightening up the studio until Uchida came back in a much improved mood, just as Mameha had predicted. He still wasn't what I would call cheerful, and in fact, he had a habit of chewing constantly at the mole in the corner of his mouth, which gave him the look of being worried. I think he felt embarrassed at his earlier behavior because he never looked directly at either of us. Soon it became apparent that he wasn't going to notice my eyes at all, and so Mameha said to him, "Don't you think Sayuri is just the prettiest thing? Have you even bothered to look at her?" It was an act of desperation, I thought, but Uchida only flicked his eyes at me like brushing a crumb from a table. Mameha seemed very disappointed. The afternoon light was already beginning to fade, so we both rose to leave. She gave the most abbreviated bow in saying goodbye. When we stepped outside, I couldn't help stopping a moment to take in the sunset, which painted the sky behind the distant hills in rusts and pinks as striking as the loveliest kimono. Even more so, because no matter how magnificent a kimono is, your hands will never glow orange in its light, but in that sunset, my hands seemed to have been dipped in some sort of iridescence. I raised them up and gazed at them for a long moment.
"Mameha-san, look," I said to her,
but she thought I was talking about the sunset and turned toward it with indifference. Uchida was standing frozen in the entryway with an expression of concentration on his face, combing one hand through a tuft of his gray hair. But he wasn't looking at the sunset at all. He was looking at me. If you've ever seen Uchida Kasaburo's famous ink painting of the young woman in a kimono, standing in a rapturous state with her eyes aglow, well, from the very beginning, he insisted the idea came from what he saw that afternoon. I've never really believed him. I can't imagine such a beautiful painting could really be based on just a girl staring foolishly at her hands in the sunset. Chapter 19. That startling month in which I first came upon the chairman again and met Nobu and Dr. Crab and Uchida Kasaburo made me feel something like a pet cricket that has at last escaped its wicker cage. For the first time in ages, I could go to bed at night believing I might not always draw as little notice in Gion as a drop of tea spilled onto the mats. I still had no understanding of Mameha's plan, or of how it would lead me to success as a geisha, or whether success as a geisha would ever lead me to the chairman. But every night I lay on my futon with his handkerchief pressed against my cheek, reliving again and again my encounter with him. I was like a temple bell that resonates long after it has been struck. Some weeks passed without word from any of the men, and Mameha and I began to worry. But at last, one morning, a secretary from Iwamura Electric phoned the Ichiriki Tea House to request my company for that evening. Mameha was delighted at the news, because she hoped the invitation had come from Nobu. I was delighted, too. I hoped it was from the chairman. Later that day, in Hatsumomo's presence, I told Auntie I would be entertaining Nobu and asked her to help me choose a kimono ensemble. To my astonishment, Hatsumomo came along to lend a hand. I'm sure that a stranger seeing us would have imagined we were members of a close family. Hatsumomo never snickered or made sarcastic comments, and in fact, she was helpful.
I think Auntie felt as puzzled as I did. We ended up settling on a powdery green kimono with a pattern of leaves in silver and vermilion, and a gray obi with gold threads. Hatsumomo promised to stop by so she could see Nobu and me together. That evening, I knelt in the hallway of the Ichiriki, feeling that my whole life had led me to this moment. I listened to the sounds of muffled laughter, wondering if one of the voices was the chairman's, and when I opened the door, I saw him there at the head of the table, and Nobu with his back to me. Well, I was so captivated by the chairman's smile, though it was really only the residue of laughter from a moment earlier, that I had to keep myself from smiling back at him. I greeted Mameha first, and then the few other geisha in the room, and finally the six or seven men. When I arose from my knees, I went straight to Nobu as Mameha expected me to do. I must have knelt closer to him than I realized, however, because he immediately slammed his sake cup onto the table in annoyance and shifted a little distance away from me. I apologized, but he paid no attention, and Mameha only frowned. I spent the rest of the time feeling out of sorts. Later, as we were leaving together, Mameha said to me, "Nobu-san is easily annoyed. Be more careful not to irritate him in the future."
"I'm sorry, ma'am. Apparently he isn't as fond of me as you thought."
"Oh, he's fond of you. If he didn't like your company, you'd have left the party in tears. Sometimes his temperament seems as gentle as a sack of gravel, but he's a kind man in his way, as you'll discover." I was invited to the Ichiriki Tea House again that week by Iwamura Electric, and many times over the weeks that followed, and not always with Mameha. She cautioned me not to stay too long for fear of making myself look unpopular. So, after an hour or so, I always bowed and excused myself, as though I were on my way to another party. Often while I was dressing for these evenings, Hatsumomo hinted she might stop by, but she never did. Then, one afternoon, when I wasn't expecting it, she informed me that she had some free time that evening and would be absolutely certain to come. I felt a bit nervous, as you can imagine, but things seemed still worse when I reached the Ichiriki and found that Nobu was absent. It was the smallest party I'd attended yet in Gion, with only two other geisha and four men. What if Hatsumomo should arrive and find me entertaining the chairman without Nobu? I'd made no headway in thinking what to do when suddenly the door slid open, and with a surge of anxiety, I saw Hatsumomo there on her knees in the hallway. My only recourse, I decided, was to act bored, as though the company of no one but Nobu could possibly interest me. Perhaps this would have been enough to save me that night, but by good fortune, Nobu arrived a few minutes afterward in any case. Hatsumomo's lovely smile grew the moment Nobu entered the room, until her lips were as rich and full as drops of blood beating at the edge of a wound. Nobu made himself comfortable at the table, and then at once, Hatsumomo suggested in an almost maternal way that I go and pour him sake. I went to settle myself near him and tried to show all the signs of a girl enchanted. Whenever he laughed, for example, I flicked my eyes toward him as though I couldn't resist. Hatsumomo was delighted and watched us so openly that she didn't even seem aware of all the men's eyes upon her, or more likely, she was simply accustomed to the attention. She was captivatingly beautiful that evening, as she always was. The young man at the end of the table did little more than smoke cigarettes and watch her. Even the chairman, who sat with his fingers draped gracefully around a sake cup, stole glimpses of her from time to time. I had to wonder if men were so blinded by beauty that they would feel privileged to live their lives with an actual demon, so long as it was a beautiful demon. I had a sudden image in my mind of the chairman stepping up into the formal entrance hall of our okia late one night to meet Hatsumomo, holding a fedora in his hand and smiling down at me as he began to unbutton his overcoat. I didn't think he'd ever really be so entranced by her beauty as to overlook the traces of cruelty that would show themselves, but one thing was certain. If Hatsumomo ever understood my feelings for him, she might very well try to seduce him, if for no other reason than to cause me pain. Suddenly, it seemed urgent to me that Hatsumomo leave the party. I knew she was there to observe the developing romance, as she put it, so I made up my mind to show her what she'd come to see. I began by touching my fingertips to my neck or my hairstyle every so often,
in order to seem worried about my appearance. When my fingers brushed one of my hair ornaments inadvertently, I came up with an idea. I waited until someone made a joke, and then, while laughing and adjusting my hair, I leaned toward Nobu. Adjusting my hair was a strange thing for me to do, I'll admit, since it was waxed into place and hardly needed attention. But my purpose was to dislodge one of my hair ornaments, a cascade of yellow and orange safflowers in silk, and let it fall into Nobu's lap. As it turned out, the wooden spine holding the ornament in my hair was embedded farther than I'd realized, but I managed to slip it out at last, and it bounced against Nobu's chest and fell onto the tatami between his crossed legs. Most everyone noticed, and no one seemed to know what to do. I planned to reach into his lap and reclaim it with girlish embarrassment, but I couldn't bring myself to reach between his legs. Nobu picked it up himself and turned it slowly by its spine. "Fetch the young maid who greeted me," he said. "Tell her I want the package I brought." I did as Nobu asked and returned to the room to find everyone waiting. He was still holding my hair ornament by the spine, so that the flowers dangled down above the table and made no effort to take the package from me when I offered it to him. "I was going to give it to you later, on your way out, but it looks as if I meant to give it to you now," he said, and nodded toward the package in a way that suggested I should open it. I felt very embarrassed with everyone watching, but I unfolded the paper wrapping and opened the little wooden box inside to find an exquisite ornamental comb on a bed of satin. The comb, in the shape of a half circle, was a showy red color adorned with bright flowers. "It's an antique I found a few days ago," Nobu said. The chairman, who was gazing wistfully at the ornament in its box on the table, moved his lips, but no sound came out at first, until he cleared his throat and then said with a strange sort of sadness, "Why, Nobu-san, I had no idea you were so sentimental." Hatsumomo rose from the table. I thought I'd succeeded in ridding myself of her, but to my surprise, she came around and knelt near me. I wasn't sure what to make of this until she removed the comb from the box and carefully inserted it into my hair, just at the base of the large pincushion-like bun. She held out her hand, and Nobu gave her the ornament of dangling safflowers, which she replaced in my hair as carefully as a mother tending to a baby. I thanked her with a little bow. "Isn't she just the loveliest creature?" she said, speaking pointedly to Nobu, and then she gave a very theatrical sigh, as though these few moments were as romantic as any she'd experienced, and left the party as I'd hoped she would. It goes without saying that men can be as distinct from each other as shrubs that bloom in different times of the year. Because although Nobu and the chairman seemed to take an interest in me within a few weeks of the sumo tournament, several months passed and still we heard nothing from Dr. Crabbe or Uchida. Mameha was very clear that we ought to wait until we heard from them, rather than finding some pretext for approaching them again, but at length she could bear the suspense no longer and went to check on Uchida one afternoon. It turned out that shortly after we'd visited him, his cat had been bitten by a badger and within a few days was dead from infection. Uchida had fallen into another drinking spell as a result. For a few days, Mameha visited to cheer him up. Finally, when his mood seemed to be turning the corner, she dressed me in an ice-blue kimono and multicolored ribbons embroidered at the hem, with only a touch of Western-style makeup to accentuate the angles, as she put it, and sent me to him bearing a present of a pearl-white kitten that had cost her I don't know how much money. I thought the kitten was adorable, but Uchida paid it little attention and instead sat squinting his eyes at me, shifting his head this way and that. A few days later, the news came that he wanted me to model in his studio. Mameha cautioned me not to speak a word to him and sent me off chaperoned by her maid, Tatsumi, who spent the afternoon nodding off in a drafty corner while Uchida moved me from spot to spot, frantically mixing his inks and painting a bit on rice paper before moving me again. If you were to go around Japan and see the various works Uchida produced while I modeled for him during that winter and the years that followed, such as one of his only surviving oil paintings hanging in the boardroom of the Sumitomo Bank in Osaka, you might imagine it was a glamorous experience to have posed for him. But actually, nothing could have been duller.
Most of the time, I did little more than sit uncomfortably for an hour or more. Mainly, I remember being thirsty, because Uchida never once offered me anything to drink. Even when I took to bring my own tea in a sealed jar, he moved it to the other side of the room so it wouldn't distract him. Following Mameha's instructions, I tried never to speak a word, even one bitter afternoon in the middle of February, when I probably should have said something and didn't. Uchida had come to sit right before me and stare at my eyes, chewing on the mole in the corner of his mouth. He had a handful of ink sticks and some water that kept icing over, but no matter how many times he ground ink in various combinations of blue and gray, he was never quite satisfied with the color and took it outside to spill it into the snow. Over the course of the afternoon, as his eyes bored into me, he became more and more angry and finally sent me away. I didn't hear a word from him for more than 2 weeks. I'd later found out he'd fallen into another drinking spell. Mameha blamed me for letting it happen. As for Dr. Crabb, when I first met him, he'd as much as promised to see Mameha and me at the Shire Tea House, and yet, as late as 6 weeks afterward, we hadn't heard a word from him. Mameha's concern grew as the weeks passed. I still knew nothing of her plan for catching Hatsumomo off balance, except that it was like a gate swinging on two hinges, one of which was Nobu and the other of which was Dr. Crabb. What she was up to with Uchida, I couldn't say, but it struck me as a separate scheme, certainly not in the very center of her plans. Finally, in late February, Mameha ran into Dr. Crabb at the Ichiriki Tea House and learned that he'd been consumed with the opening of a new hospital in Osaka. Now that most of the work was behind him, he hoped to renew my acquaintance at the Shire Tea House the following week. You'll recall that Mameha had claimed I would be overwhelmed with invitations if I showed my face at the Ichiriki. This was why Dr. Crabb asked we join him at the Shire instead. Mameha's real motive was to keep clear of Hatsumomo, of course, and yet as I prepared to meet the doctor again, I couldn't help feeling uneasy that Hatsumomo might find us anyway. But the moment I set eyes on the Shire, I nearly burst out laughing, for it was clearly a place Hatsumomo would go out of her way to avoid. It made me think of one shriveled little blossom on a tree in full bloom. Gion continued to be a bustling community, even during the last years of the Depression, but the Shire Tea House, which had never been important to begin with, had only withered further. The only reason a man as wealthy as Dr. Crabb patronized such a place is that he hadn't always been so wealthy. During his early years, the Shire was probably the best he could do. Just because the Ichiriki finally welcomed him didn't mean he was free to sever his bond with the Shire. When a man takes a mistress, he doesn't turn around and divorce his wife. That evening in the Shire, I poured sake while Mameha told a story. And all the while, Dr. Crabb sat with his elbow sticking out so much that he sometimes bumped one of us with them and turned to nod in apology. He was a quiet man, as I discovered. He spent most of his time looking down at the table through his little round glasses and every so often slipped pieces of sashimi underneath his mustache in a way that made me think of a boy hiding something beneath a floor covering. When we finally left that evening, I thought we'd failed and wouldn't see much of him because normally a man who'd enjoyed himself so little wouldn't bother coming back to Gion. But as it turned out, we heard from Dr. Crabb the next week, and nearly every week afterward over the following months. Things went along smoothly with the doctor until one afternoon in the middle of March, when I did something foolish and very nearly ruined all Mameha's careful planning. I'm sure many a young girl has spoiled her prospects in life by refusing to do something expected of her, or by behaving badly toward an important man, or some such thing, but the mistake I made was so trivial I wasn't even aware I'd done anything. It happened in the Okia during the course of about a minute, not long after lunch one cold day, while I knelt on the wooden walkway with my shamisen. Hatsumomo was strolling past on her way to the toilet. If I'd had shoes, I would have stepped down onto the dirt corridor to get out of her way, but as it was, I could do nothing but struggle to get up from my knees with my legs and arms nearly frozen. If I'd been quicker, Hatsumomo probably wouldn't have bothered speaking to me, but during that moment, while I rose to my feet, she said, "The German ambassador is coming to town, but Pumpkin isn't free to entertain him. Why don't you ask Mameha to arrange for you to take Pumpkin's place?" After this, she let out a laugh, as if to say the idea of my doing such a thing was as ridiculous as serving a dish of acorn shells to the emperor. The German ambassador was causing quite a stir in Gion at the time. During this period in 1935, a new government had recently come to power in Germany, and though I've never understood much about politics, I do know that Japan was moving away from the United States during these years and was eager to make a good impression on the new German ambassador. Everyone in Gion wondered who would be given the honor of entertaining him during his upcoming visit. When Hatsumomo spoke to me, I ought to have lowered my head in shame and made a great show of lamenting the misery of my life compared with pumpkins. But as it happened, I had just been musing about how much my prospects seemed to have improved and how successfully Mameha and I had kept her plan from Hatsumomo, whatever her plan was. My first instinct when Hatsumomo spoke was to smile, but instead I kept my face a mask and felt pleased with myself that I'd given nothing away. Hatsumomo gave me an odd look. I ought to have realized right then that something had passed through her mind. I stepped quickly to one side and she passed me. That was the end of it as far as I was concerned. Then, a few days later, Mameha and I went to the Shirei Tea House to meet Dr. Crab once again. But as we rolled open the door, we found Pumpkin slipping her feet into her shoes to leave. I was so startled to see her, I wondered what on earth could possibly have brought her there. Then Hatsumomo stepped down into the entryway as well. "Good evening, Mameha-san," Hatsumomo said. "And look who's with you. It's the apprentice the doctor used to be so fond of." I'm sure Mameha felt as shocked as I did, but she didn't show it. "Why, Hatsumomo-san," she said, "I scarcely recognize you. But my goodness, you're aging well." Hatsumomo wasn't actually old. She was only 28 or 29. I think Mameha was just looking for something nasty to say. "I expect you're on your way to see the doctor," Hatsumomo said. "Such an interesting man. I only hope he'll still be happy to see you. Well, goodbye." Hatsumomo looked cheerful as she walked away, but in the light from the avenue, I could see a look of sorrow on Pumpkin's face. Mameha and I slipped out of our shoes without speaking a word. Neither of us knew what to say. The Shirei's gloomy atmosphere seemed as thick as the water in a pond that night. The air smelled of stale makeup. The damp plaster was peeling in the corners of the rooms. I would have given anything to turn around and leave. When we slid open the door from the hallway, we found the mistress of the tea house keeping Dr. Crab company. Usually she stayed a few minutes, even after we'd arrived, probably to charge the doctor for her time. But tonight she excused herself the moment we entered and didn't even look up as she passed. Dr. Crab was sitting with his back facing us, so we skipped the formality of bowing and went instead to join him at the table. "You seem tired, doctor," Mameha said. "How are you this evening?" Dr. Crab didn't speak. He just twirled his glass of beer on the table to waste time, even though he was an efficient man and never wasted a moment if he could help it. "Yes, I am rather tired," he said at last. "I don't feel much like talking." And with that, he drank down the last of his beer and stood to leave. Mameha and I exchanged looks. When Dr. Crab reached the door to the room, he faced us and said, "I certainly do not appreciate when people I have trusted turn out to have misled me." Afterward, he left without closing the door. Mameha and I were too stunned to speak. At length, she got up and slid the door shut. Back at the table, she smoothed her kimono and then pinched her eyes closed in anger and said to me, "All right, Sayuri, what exactly did you say to Hatsumomo?"
"Mameha-san, after all this work, I promise you I would never do anything to ruin my own chances."
"The doctor seems to have thrown you aside, as though you're no better than an empty sack. I'm sure there's a reason, but we won't find it out until we know what Hatsumomo said to him tonight."
"How can we possibly do that?"
"Pumpkin was here in the room. You must go to her and ask." I wasn't at all sure Pumpkin would speak with me, but I said I would try, and Mameha seemed satisfied with this. She stood and prepared to leave, but I stayed where I was until she turned to see what was keeping me.
"Mameha-san, may I ask a question?" I said. "Now Hatsumomo knows I've been spending time with the doctor, and probably she understands the reason why. Dr. Crabb certainly knows why. You know why. Even Pumpkin may know why. I'm the only one who doesn't. Won't you be kind enough to explain your plan to me?"
Mameha looked as if she felt very sorry I'd ask this question. For a long moment she looked everywhere but at me, but she finally let out a sigh and knelt at the table again to tell me what I wanted to know.
"You know perfectly well," she began, "that Uchida-san looks at you with the eyes of an artist. But the doctor is interested in something else, and so is Nobu. Do you know what is meant by the homeless eel?"
I had no idea what she was talking about, and I said so.
"Men have a kind of, well, an eel on them," she said. "Women don't have it, but men do. It's located..."
"I think I know what you're talking about," I said. "But I didn't know it was called an eel."
"It isn't an eel, really," Mameha said. "But pretending it's an eel makes things so much easier to understand. So let's think of it that way. Here's the thing. This eel spends its entire life trying to find a home. And what do you think women have inside them? Caves where the eel likes to live. This cave is where the blood comes from every month when the clouds pass over the moon, as we sometimes say." I was old enough to understand what Mameha meant by the passage of clouds over the moon because I'd been experiencing it for a few years already. The first time, I couldn't have felt more panicked if I'd sneezed and found pieces of my brain in the handkerchief. I really was afraid I might be dying until Auntie had found me washing out a bloody rag and explained that bleeding was just part of being a woman. "You may not know this about eels," Mameha went on, "but they're quite territorial. When they find a cave they like, they wiggle around inside it for a while to be sure that... well, to be sure it's a nice cave, I suppose. And when they've made up their minds that it's comfortable, they mark the cave as their territory by spitting. Do you understand?"
If Mameha had simply told me what she was trying to say, I'm sure I would have been shocked, but at least I'd have an easier time sorting it all out. Years later, I discovered that things had been explained to Mameha in exactly the same way by her own older sister.
"Here's the part that's going to seem very strange to you," Mameha went on, as if what she'd already told me didn't. "Men actually like doing this. In fact, they like it very much. There are even men who do little in their lives besides search for different caves to let their eels live in. A woman's cave is particularly special to a man if no other eel has ever been in it before. Do you understand? We call this mizwage."
"We call what mizwage?"
"The first time a woman's cave is explored by a man's eel. That is what we call mizwage. Now, mizu means water, and age means raise up or place on, so that the term mizwage sounds as if it might have something to do with raising up water or placing something on the water. If you get three geisha in a room, all of them will have different ideas about where the term comes from." Now that Mameha had finished her explanation, I felt only more confused, though I tried to pretend it all made a certain amount of sense. "I suppose you can guess why the doctor likes to play around in Gion," Mameha continued. "He makes a great deal of money from his hospital. Except for what he needs to support his family, he spends it in the pursuit of mizwage. It may interest you to know, Sayuri-san, that you are precisely the sort of young girl he likes best. I know this very well, because I was one myself." As I later learned, a year or two before I'd come to Gion, Dr. Crabb had paid a record amount for Mameha's mizwage, maybe 7,000 yen or 8,000 yen. This may not sound like much, but at that time it was a sum that even someone like Mother, whose every thought was about money and how to get more of it, might see only once or twice in a lifetime. Mameha's mizwage had been so costly partly because of her fame, but there was another reason, as she explained to me that afternoon. Two very wealthy men had bid against each other to be her mizwage patron. One was Dr. Crabb. The other was a businessman named Fujikado. Ordinarily, men didn't compete this way in Gion. They all knew each other and preferred to reach agreements on things, but Fujikado lived on the other side of the country and came to Gion only occasionally. He didn't care if he offended Dr. Crabb, and Dr. Crabb, who claimed to have some aristocratic blood in him, he
hated self-made men like Fujikoto, even though, in truth, he was a self-made man too for the most part. When Mameha noticed at the sumo tournament that Nobu seemed taken with me, she thought at once of how much Nobu resembled Fujikoto, self-made and, to a man like Dr. Crab, repulsive. With Hatsumomo chasing me around like a housewife chasing a cockroach, I certainly wasn't going to become famous the way Mameha had and end up with an expensive mizwage as a result, but if these two men found me appealing enough, they might start a bidding war, which could put me in the same position to repay my debts as if I'd been a popular apprentice all along. This was what Mameha had meant by catching Hatsumomo off balance. Hatsumomo was delighted that Nobu found me attractive. What she didn't realize was that my popularity with Nobu would very likely drive up the price of my mizwage. Clearly, we had to reclaim Dr. Crab's affections. Without him, Nobu could offer what he wanted for my mizwage, that is, if he turned out to have any interest in it at all. I wasn't sure he would, but Mameha assured me that a man doesn't cultivate a relationship with a 15-year-old apprentice geisha unless he has her mizwage in mind. "You can bet it isn't your conversation he's attracted to," she told me. I tried to pretend I didn't feel hurt by this. Chapter 20. Looking back, I can see that this conversation with Mameha marked a shift in my view of the world. Beforehand, I'd known nothing about mizwage. I was still a naive girl with little understanding. But afterward, I could begin to see what a man like Dr. Crab wanted from all the time and money he spent in Gion. Once you know this sort of thing, you can never unknow it. I couldn't think about him again in quite the same way. Back at the Okia later that night, I waited in my room for Hatsumomo and Pumpkin to come up the stairs. It was an hour or so after midnight when they finally did. I could tell Pumpkin was tired from the way her hands slapped on the steps, because she sometimes came up the steep stairway on all fours like a dog. Before closing the door to their room, Hatsumomo summoned one of the maids and asked for a beer.
"No, wait a minute," she said. "Bring two. I want Pumpkin to join me."
"Please, Hatsumomo-san," I heard Pumpkin say. "I'd rather drink spit."
"You're going to read aloud to me while I drink mine, so you might as well have one. Beside, I hate when people are too sober. It's sickening." After this, the maid went down the stairs. When she came up a short time later, I heard glasses clinking on the tray she carried. For a long while, I sat with my ear to the door of my room, listening to Pumpkin's voice as she read an article about a new kabuki actor. Finally, Hatsumomo stumbled out into the hallway and rolled open the door to the upstairs toilet.
"Pumpkin," I heard her say, "don't you feel like a bowl of noodles?"
"No, ma'am."
"See if you can find the noodle vendor and get some for yourself so you can keep me company."
Pumpkin sighed and went right down the stairs, but I had to wait for Hatsumomo to return to her room before creeping down to follow. I might not have caught up with Pumpkin, except that she was so exhausted she couldn't do much more than wander along at about the speed mud oozes down a hill, and with about as much purpose. When I finally found her, she looked alarmed to see me and asked what was the matter.
"Nothing is the matter," I said, "except I desperately need your help."
"Oh, Chiyo-chan," she said to me.
I think she was the only person who still called me that.
"I don't have any time. I'm trying to find noodles for Hatsumomo, and she's going to make me eat some, too. I'm afraid I'll throw up all over her."
"Pumpkin, you poor thing," I said. "You look like ice when it has begun to melt."
Her face was drooping with exhaustion, and the weight of all her clothing seemed as if it might pull her right onto the ground. I told her to go and sit down, that I would find the noodles and bring them to her. She was so tired she didn't even protest, but simply handed me the money and sat down on a bench by the Shirakawa stream. It took me some time to find a noodle vendor, but at last I returned carrying two bowls of steaming noodles. Pumpkin was sound asleep with her head back and her mouth open, as though she were hoping to catch raindrops. It was about 2 in the morning, and a few people were still strolling around. One group of men seemed to think Pumpkin was the funniest thing they'd seen in weeks, and I admit it was odd to see an apprentice in her full regalia snoring on a bench. When I'd set the bowls down beside her and awakened her as gently as I knew how, I said,
"Pumpkin, I want so much to ask you a favor, but I'm afraid you won't be happy when you hear what it is."
"It doesn't matter," she said. "Nothing makes me happy anymore." "You were in the room earlier this evening when Hatsumomo talked with the doctor. I'm afraid my whole future may be affected by that conversation." Hatsumomo